The following Dharma talk was given by Jodi Hojin Kimmel at the Zen Center of New York City. Hojin Sensei is the abbot of the Zen Center and head priest at Zen Mountain Monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org/zcnyc. Thanks for listening.
Good morning, everyone. It's great to see so many people here. I don't know what is in the water this morning, but it's wonderful to have such a full zendo. So whatever you brought you here, please honor that, that this was your choice this morning. This morning, I wanted to introduce you to a very powerful woman teacher in the tradition, actually in the Tibetan lineage, who actually forged a whole new teaching. Her name is Machik Lobdrun. And I'll tell you about my relationship to her and how I found her. This was during the 11th century. She was born in 1055 in Tibet. And she was the only woman that became recognized in that tradition at that time, tracing a lineage back to the Buddha. So it was a very strong feminine rising, and it happened to be in the body of a woman. And it's said that when she was born, she was already showing signs of having dharmic sort of abilities. By the age of 6 or 7, she was speed reading sutras and understanding them. If you have a 6-year-old or a 7-year-old, imagine that. That she could memorize the Heart Sutra, which was one of her favorite sutras, and identified with Tara and Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva as an emanation of her. She had vivid ability to visualize as well, and often received visions. She really understood the Heart Sutra. Form is exactly emptiness. Emptiness is exactly form. And how each of us, being Avalokiteshvara, can clearly hear the cries of the world and see the emptiness of all the 5 conditions. That was her major teaching. And she trusted her visions, and she worked with the internal demons, Maras, we might call them, as really important and welcome on the path. That all the self-loathing we might have, self-hatred, all of that kind of energy, all these projections, is the juiciness of our life. Isn't that great? All the good and bad that we may have and find in us, regrets, are all very important energies to bring us to the path and to liberate our minds and our hearts if we don't feed the egoic aspect of it all. It becomes what she calls a nectar, that all of these things that we may create in our mind, whatever they are, can be a nectar. I like that. A sweet nectar for our awakening. How nice to think of it that way. And so her main teaching was feeding, not fighting. Feeding, not fighting. She was first a nun, and then she received instructions to form a family. And so she actually had a few children. And then she received instruction that she should go into a more intensive training and leave her family. And she did that. She actually put her husband in charge and said, "You take care of the kids. I got to go practice intensively." That was new. So she's a heroine of sorts to me, a wise woman, a powerful guide. And at that time when I discovered her teachings, there were no books out like there are today on women ancestors and the lineage we hadn't received from Susan Murcott or many of these teachers who wrote about other beings in the lineage that were practicing the Dharma. So it was very good news. And it said when she approached her teacher was Dampa Sangye. And she said, "Please, I want to wake up from suffering. I want to alleviate the suffering of myself and of others and be of benefit. I want to help all sentient beings." And so Lama, so Dampa Sangye gave her these five practical relative practices that come to us here today. We've studied slogans before, so they're called slogans that we can practice. Her first one, and there's five of them. Confess your hidden faults. Confess your hidden faults. Approach what you find repulsive. Really? Think about everything that repulses you, and it's saying, approach. Approach what you find repulsive. A little intimidating, wouldn't you say? Help those you cannot help. It's also been translated as, or you don't want to. Help those you don't want to help. Help them. Anything you're attached to, let it go. Or another translation is, or give that. Anything you're attached to, give it. And then the last is, go to the places that scare you. Okay. And I think that all of these slogans are going to the places that scare us. This is her teaching. This is her teaching. Go to the places that scare you. The way out is in and through, and understanding what it is. So what is it that scares you? What are the places that scare you? And what I loved about her is she was so interested in her blind spots. I needed to hear that. Her afflictions, her hidden faults, her regrets. She was very interested in finding them, in learning about them, the actions of her body, mouth, and thought. So she trained, as we are, to see them clearer and clearer. So there's less and less ignorance, less and less chance to cause harm in ourselves and to damage others. And she wanted help to create no harm. And when something was displeasing, upsetting, revolting, she would do like we try to do, to find a way to approach it. Maybe we don't, but some of us do. We recognize that. What is it that's scaring me? And we find a way to approach. So she had this willingness that we can develop in training. And she used various practices, as we have, as you have, to find your way to it. So when she felt greedy or attached to something and didn't want to give it away, that was her practice. And over time, within all her training, she introduced her own teaching methods to approach the things that we're afraid of. And it was from our direct experience, and the practice was called CHUD. It's spelled C-H-O with two dots over the O-D, but it's pronounced CHUD, CHUD, which means severing or to cut away that which is no longer serving or working for us in our liberation. And visualization was part of the practice. That's Machik, I have her here looking at me. You could see her in one of her dancing modes. And she has teaching implements. It's a little hard to see, but you can look her up. I just wanted her right there to look at. So what we practice is giving, and what we give is our body. We give our body, our mouth, and our thought, and she practiced this giving in a major way and visualizing and actually doing it too. And she spent her life, her whole teaching, working with these five slogans and giving them to her students. And as far out as they seem, they're quite practical, actually. So Dhamma Samgye also gave her this other absolute fundamental teaching. He says, if you do not grasp with your mind, you will find a fresh state of being. Think about that. If you don't grasp with your mind, you'll find a fresh state of being. Because usually we're bringing in the past or anticipating the future. If you do not grasp your mind, you'll bring in a fresh state of being. Sentient beings are limitless as the sky. Be aware. Find the Buddha inside you. So there's these practical instructions, being in a body, the relative instructions, confess your hidden faults, approach what you find repulsive, those, and then this absolute nature, which relates to the Heart Sutra, and invites this feeding and not fighting, because as Avalokiteshvara clearly saw the emptiness of all the five conditions, the karmic seeds, the conditioning that runs through us that we have to work with and that we should be enjoy this process, that it's coming to us, that we're seeing it, that there's awareness, right? She shared that nothing attacks us but our own confusion. No solid obstacles except our own hardening views, our need to protect ourselves from being touched. Maybe the enemy is that we don't like the way things are right now, wish it to go away fast, yet nothing does go away until we go through it and get what we need to know and can release it. And part of our fundamental misunderstanding of a lifetime is not knowing who we are, is this fixed self that we create, right? So this is what she's pointing to. Approach what you find repulsive. What might we see in ourselves? Deep and dark things in our mind we might fear, and we judge ourselves. Rejecting parts of ourselves. Who doesn't do this? We kind of wash over. Oh no, not that. And she's saying, yeah, welcome. Welcome this. It's uncomfortable. You will be uncomfortable. We are uncomfortable. But don't reject. And if we are repulsed internally seeing it, we will be repulsed externally as well. So in the practice and time, we begin to realize nothing is outside the mind. Thoughts are nothing solid. That's what we're seeing. Not defining, not inherent, not with permanent characteristics. Otherwise, we can't practice. We won't change. We can't move. So it's got to be malleable. It's got to be open and fluid. But we do have a strong karmic understanding of our thoughts, and we box ourselves in. We box others in. If you do not grasp the mind, you will find a state of being that is very fresh. If we don't put ourselves in a cage, It's wide open. After all, what are we trying to do in our practice? We're trying to see the nature of our mind, which we learn is everything. The three worlds are nothing but mine. The three worlds are desire, form, and formlessness, are nothing but mind. And to liberate the thoughts, our fundamental misunderstanding. And so this sitting meditation, Zazen, that you received, some of you, just for the first time, presents itself to us as a direct experience of sounds, sights, smells, emotions, shapes, everything. A direct experience, a fresh state of being, if we don't grasp. It's very fresh as it enters all of our senses. But of course, we do more to it as it's coming. It's very fast. We don't even notice what's happening. Like yesterday, we went to the Botanic Gardens. We had a retreat. We went in quietly to this space. And that's how we entered. We entered through the senses, just opening our senses up. And then we made live recordings, began an expressive aspect to the retreat, an illuminated journal, just recording what we see, smell, taste, touch, feel very directly. So Machig presents these slogans for us, students of the Dharma, to take right into our life, to help us pause, connect, sever, cut, that's should, what's no longer needed to bring us peace, goodwill. And we'll have plenty of discomfort as we work with this, and that's okay. That's good, actually. It's like if it makes us slightly uncomfortable what we're doing, that's not a bad thing. Like, that's how we become one with what we might regret, is because something's uncomfortable, something we might have done with our body, mouth, or thought. And if it doesn't feel right in us, how do we become one with what happened? Either what we did, what someone did to us, either way. Buddha nature will never be overtaken. Your Buddha nature. You came in with it, you'll die with it. It's not created. We can't avoid having an experience we can't control. And yet there is calm beneath the surface. That's on us. We can't control the environment, but we can work with our heart and mind. There's this singer, Wah. Does anybody know Wah? Oh, good. I love her. And she has this line I always love. She sings, how does the breath enter the body with love? How does the breath enter the body with love? And she sings it a few times. That's Machig. How does the breath enter the body with love? That's her concern. And she'll tell us straight up, like the Buddha, life is challenging, sometimes sweet, sometimes bitter. Sometimes we have a tense body. Sometimes we're relaxed, very open. Yeah. Sometimes we have a headache, a stomach ache. Sometimes we're kind of 100% healthy. She says, from an awakened perspective, trying to tie up all these loose ends is a death because it involves rejecting our basic experience. It's aggressive to think this way, trying to flatten out all the rough spots and imperfections for a nice smooth ride. But we so want to. We think everything should be a nice, smooth ride, and it is with the bumps. It's only a bump when we don't want the bump. But if you just bump, it's a smooth ride, right over the bump. Sever what is not needed. Don't grasp appearances. So I found Maciek, and this was way back when I started training. It's like 1990-ish when I went to the monastery, and somebody gave me a subscription to the Sun magazine, and so I was leafing through it, and there was a picture of a Tibetan woman in a vast landscape. Saw some birds there with a child on her back, you know, wrapped up. And she was looking at the photographer. So there was a photographer up there. And so when you open that page, it was big, and she was looking right into me. And I disappeared in her. That was me. I never had this before, where I was her in that image, and everything else fell away. I didn't see any, I just merged. And after a few minutes, I sort of came out of it. I was like, whoa, like I was there. And then I looked around and I realized there was bodies laying all over and vultures. And she was in a charnel ground. But there is this tremendous shock of recognition that I stood in that exact spot as that person. And she was high atop that mountain in the sky burial platform, what we might today call a graveyard, although ours are pretty cleaned up, aren't they? A lot of grass, some stones, some carved angels, names and dates. This was not that. And this vision of being her came up in my dreams for a while. It just would come. Here on this earth, this body chopped up in all stages of deterioration. And these big majestic vultures, the size of her child, and other small birds, were picking and pecking, tearing away the bones and flesh, cleaning up. And she was taking her child there for homeschooling. Pretty good. Perhaps the closest thing to a charnel ground today might be an emergency room, especially during the pandemic, where the images that were coming in were looking like that, actually. And some of the people that I knew that were working there were also having that same feeling. But they also said that the space was totally grounded in honesty. It was such an honest space, what was happening, of how the human realm functions. That's what they felt there. They felt so close to their workers. Some of you may have been in such a situation. It smells, it bleeds, it's full of unpredictability. They were right in it, right in it. A place that at the same time with all that was so beneficial and pure in intent to save living beings. That's what got them through. That's what they really felt in that space. Help those you cannot help or you don't want to. People bonded in giving themselves away, giving their bodies away. And I remember a while back, a friend asked me what I wanted to do with my body when I died. And I said, I would like to go to the birds. And that just popped out of me. And I didn't know about these charnel grounds. I wasn't joking, but I thought, oh, it would be really nice to have animals share, like just peck away, like a roadkill. It's a cleanup. I felt it was a nice giving relationship, and I wouldn't mind that to be devoured by other living beings. Sorry if you find this repulsive. You might be practicing right now. Approach what you find repulsive. And recently I was walking on the road by the monastery, and I had my drawing stuff with me, and I came upon a few crows cleaning up. I love crows. They were very concentrated, also playful. Sometimes they would bump each other from the meal. You know, one would be hogging it, and another one would push them away and take the space. But I parked myself on the guardrail to watch. Pema Chodron said, we should enjoy these slogans. So I began to wonder, what is the ritual around these burials up in the sky? And I wanted to look for some information on it. And one day I was at my teacher's house, Daito Roshi, and I said to him, I had come across this image in the sky, in the sun of this woman, and I told him what happened to me. And I said, do you know anything about these sky burials? And he pulled a book from the shelf, it was still wrapped, and it was called Machik Lubdrun and the Foundations of Chud by Jerome Idu. And I asked him, can you tell me about this? Can you tell me about these sky burials? And he made a joke and he said, it's for the birds. And then he placed the book in my hand and he said, here, you read about it. And as on the cover it said, anyone who is involved with Machik's activity will be liberated. And I was like, all right, I'm in. I'm associated. We're doing it. And she said, it is only by meeting and even nurturing whatever we most consider other that true liberation can be attained. As long as there is something or someone out there, we are held in the prison walls of our own dualistic thinking. What a profound teaching on radical inclusivity. That we become radically inclusive with ourselves inside and out. As long as there's someone or something out there that's not us, that's separate, you and I are the same thing, and at the same time, I am not you and you are not me. But in that fundamental, absolute sense, we're the same thing. We are the same thing. And out of that, all these differences. Look at us. Amazing. All these miraculous beings of awakened nature. Not just here, but all over. Every single thing is awakened nature. She says, with a loving mind, cherish more than a child the hostile gods and demons of apparent existence, and tenderly surround yourself with them. Cut the mistaken notion of self-identity, which I set myself over and apart from all that is not me. That's all. So her view is really timely now. Because we so want to say, that's not me. That's not me. We have to go a little bit deeper, whatever, when we hear ourselves say that. At least I do. I shouldn't say what you have to do, but I take that as nectar. That I'm repulsed. That I don't want to approach. That I'm scared. That I don't want to help. I don't want to do it. That's the nectar to take. There was a course that Soltram Elion teaches, and some of her assistants are now teaching her disciples, called Feeding Your Demons. You can get her book. But it's a process you go through of learning how to make your demons your allies to work with you. But you have to first see them and put them outside yourself and look at them. Because most of the time, we don't even want to look, right? Who wants, like, something's nagging, like, eh? You don't want to look. Like, did you ever dream that something's chasing you, a monster? Has anybody had that dream? Yeah, like persistently. And for a while, we don't turn around. We may never, but we just keep going and like shut doors, bolt them, and it goes right through. And it's still on us, right? We're like, oh my God, still coming, still coming. But then the moment we look, the demon stops. And it goes, brrr, because that's all. We just want to see this aspect of ourself. Sukhni Rinpoche called it our beautiful monsters. They want to be seen and appreciated and treated with compassion. And mostly, we're not treating it with compassion. That's why it keeps coming stronger and stronger, because it's a tender part of us, this demon, that just wants us to look at it. Look at ourselves. Not be scared, not be frightened by ourselves, our own mind. Nectar. Yes, so she says the process we go through is that these demons need employment. They need a job. And they want to work for us. So we have to employ them. We have to employ them to show us our goodness, our juiciness, our aliveness, our being alive. We need to hear their voice as allies, that they're working on our behalf. Okay? So can we let them be? And what we usually do is we take that energy when there's a monster in us and we're believing it. We take that energy and instead we try and regain ground with it. Like, see, told you. I suck. Excuse my French. And we use it to try to make things secure and predictable again and real again, to fool ourselves about what's truly, really true. So she says, in effect, pick one of your monsters. Pick one. One of the most difficult aspects of your experience that shows you where you create a boundary between yourself and yourself, or yourself and an other. What you don't want to be in your experience. Pick something. A tightly held belief. And get insight how that we throw kerosene on emotions so it will feel more real. Or we spread blame, or we self-justify. And we don't have to consider that obstacle a problem. How wonderful. And say yes to this no, to the yes of the Heart Sutra. Try and see, form is exactly emptiness. Emptiness is exactly form. But we do this silly thing again and again because, she says, we have little tolerance to dwell in uncertainty, little tolerance of feeling awkward in the pain of not knowing. And when we land in an unknown wilderness and say, no, no, not that, she says, go right there and open your arms and embrace it. This is not easy to practice, but it's liberating when we can sit in and through all the machinations and find the clearing in the forest of brambles. So Matchik was asked to define what a demon was. And this is how she replied. A demon is not some great black thing that petrifies whoever sees it. A demon is anything that obstructs the achievement of freedom. There is no greater demon than a fixation to a self. Until this is cut off, all devils wait with open mouths. So clearly her understanding was that demons were the fruits, and that was in her deep inquiry into the nature of experience. Just like a deep breath to hear this. Can we deeply be curious too? Maybe even say, thank you for showing your demon face. Just hold your hand on yourself. Thank you, honey, for showing your demon face. Wonderful that you came and appeared. Demons and Maras don't like practice. They don't like to practice because they're afraid. When we're afraid that we'll actually see through the mind's illusion of control, illusion of a solid self, it's so familiar. It'll feel like a new frontier. We won't know. We'll feel ungrounded, unmoored. Yep. What a rich place to be so open and vulnerable. Even the Buddha continued to experience negative mind states. Till his death. What did he say? I'm always aware of Mara. He knew. So if we have in our mind, like, we're going to, like, practice and, like, clean up everything, like, in some imagined ideal way, forget about it. Too much control. Instead, what about cleaning up by acceptance, embracing? That's what we think doesn't belong. It's a whole different mindset. Fresh. Fresh. Apparently, she gave up prestigious life to become a wandering yogini. She became a mother of a few children and then felt called to practice the Dharma more intensively. As I said, she left her children with her husband. He agreed. And she returned to study and train with her teacher full time. And eventually she became her teacher's teacher. Isn't that great? There's a bird called the oven bird at the monastery. You know this bird? We don't hear it in New York. I don't think it's here because it's deep in the forest. And its call is teacher, 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 teacher. I call it the teacher bird. Teacher, 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 teacher. And you never see it. It's very elusive. And she spent time as a hermit, but her total dedication was in service to her students. And her children, as I said, became her chief disciples. So there's a wonderful saying, truth has no handles. Truth, the ultimate view, gives us nothing to grasp, nothing to stand on. It refuses to give us solid ground. Cut away your ground, says Matchik. She says, have no view at all. That's right view. By not holding on to fixed views, as we chant in the Metta Sutra, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, is not born again into this world. You're that pure-hearted one. Having no fixed views, we're not born again into this world. But we will for a while. Most of us will be born again and again as a self comes in and is born again. But it's an invitation to abandon the solid ground that beliefs grant us. I hear my teacher say, aim high. Shugen Roshi always says, we aim high in practice, not placing limits on where there are none. So it's not like I aim high that I'm going to become a bookkeeper. That is not happening. So not that kind of, like, we have to know there are certain limits. That's not what he's talking about. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I will become a bookkeeper and numbers will suddenly be very clear to me. Not yet. And so I found this article, which I want to end with, which I chuckled about because it kind of, it's called Ode to Low Expectations by James Parker. He's a writer for The Atlantic. It's really witty and direct of how the heart opens, how wisdom is already awakened and is awakened, and this connection with our fundamental Buddha nature. And you can hear him going through his process and sensory awareness. It's not long. I'm going to read it just as he wrote it. It was 1993. I was sitting over a plate of eggs in the new Piccadilly Cafe in Soho, London. Things were not going well. As a man, as a person, as a unit of society, I was barely functioning. More acutely, I was having panic attacks in an era when people didn't say panic attack. They just said, oh dear. As far as I was concerned, I was going insane. I took a depressing slurp from my mug, then put it back down. As I did so, the side of my hand touched the Formica tabletop, and I felt the radiant heat from where the mug had been resting a second before. Or more accurately, I registered it through my private cerebral drizzle, the continuous joy, canceling brain rain, that was my mental reality at the time. I noted it. Energy, life, jiggling molecules, the world, a message from the fire of generosity at the heart of the universe. And the message was this: one day you'll be able to simply appreciate what's in front of you. The tea, the cafe, London, the little lens of warmth on the table. One day, this will be enough. Strive for excellence by all means. My God, please strive for excellence. Excellence alone will haul us out of the hogwash. But lower the bar and keep it low when it comes to your personal attachment to the world. Gratification? Satisfaction, having your needs met, fool's gold. If you can get a buzz of animal cheer from the rubbishy sandwich you're eating, the daft movie you're watching, the highly difficult person you're talking to, you're in business. And when trouble comes, you'll be fitter for it. Reality is B+, says my friend Carlo. I'd probably give him an A-, but I take his point. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things, wrote Gerard Manley Hopkins. But there also lives the dearest shoddiness. We're half finished down here, always building and collapsing, rigging up this and that, dropped hammers and flapping tarps everywhere. Revise your expectations downward. Extend forgiveness to your ignorant friends. Extend forgiveness to your ignorant self. Make it a practice. Come to rest in actuality. Confess your hidden faults. Approach what you find repulsive. Help those you cannot help or you don't want to. Anything you're attached to, let it go. Give it away. Go to the places that scare you. Come to rest in actuality. May your lives go well. May our lives go well.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.